Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. My guest today on Research Matters is Professor Carmel Vassallo. Professor Vassallo graduated in economics and development from the University of Westminster in London and did postgraduate work in Hispanic studies and history at the Universities of Navarre and the University of Barcelona. He has researched extensively in Spain, Portugal, France, Italy, Tunisia and Malta on the latter's commercial network and mercantile diaspora, the subject, I believe, of his PhD, and also on other aspects of maritime history. Professor Vassallo is co-founder and coordinator of the Mediterranean Maritime History Network, about which we shall be speaking at length during this chat, as well as being the head of the Department of Spanish within the Faculty of Arts. There we have your academic history in a nutshell, Professor.
That's it.
can all be fitted into two paragraphs.
I can only make them one if you want. I'm all for succinct.
Well, obviously, from those few words, we've sort of gathered that your chief interest is the sea maritime history, commercial networking, and I suppose, like most BA students, I was introduced to the socio-economic aspects of maritime history through lectures on Brodel. And university study, I suppose, is all about making connections, and he had this wonderful ability to link economics, politics and war, and he sort of gave a very deep picture of the Mediterranean, particularly in the reign of Philip II. He was looking at a large country like Spain and the enormous influence that the Mediterranean in general had on Spain and Spain on the Mediterranean. In your initial studies, then, you sort of turned things around and looked at a small country and looked at how Malta fitted into the Mediterranean mercantile, commercial, economic Mediterranean context.
Yes, well, more or less. I'm always a bit reluctant, but Malta is a country in formal terms. I mean, it's the United Nations, etc., etc. But sometimes it's very easy to forget the sense. One has got to keep a sense of scale. I like to think of Malta, in fact, as a bit of a city-state, you know, in the same way that I suppose Singapore is in present times, or Macau was before it was taken over by the Chinese again, and so on. So it's important to not lose sight of that when we deal with anything to do with Malta, because people often I believe commit the mistake of trying to compare Spain and Malta, or talking of Spain and Malta in the same kind of in the same sentence. I mean, we've got to compare like with like at the end of the day. This is, in my humble opinion, a tiny little island which for most of its history has been, as you well know as a historian and archaeologist yourself, or at least an interest in archaeology, which I believe you have, an appendage of the greater island, which is Sicily. But by a set of circumstances, quite fortuitous, I mean, historical circumstances, the Brits were here and the order was here. So it so happened that for these reasons, we ended up separate from where we really belong in geographical terms, which is Sicily and Italy. But anyway, that's all in the past, and we are a small country. And the idea was, in fact, to demonstrate that even as far as this very tiny outcrop of land is concerned, the maritime history really is much more than the way we've traditionally handled it here. We have tended to live in the shadow, understandably, of the naval bases, and the order first and subsequently the British, and it seemed as if there was nothing else. In fact, in the wider context, maritime history is often conceived by many people still as a very fairly narrow endeavor, fairly narrow field, often to do with naval history, which is war, basically, or what some people in the business would call power projection. You talk of history, and it's often synonymous with naval history in many people's minds. And this has been one of my primary preoccupations, basically to try to communicate this notion that maritime history is really a much more than that. And this is particularly important in the context of Malta, because Malta, despite the fact that it's an island and it's an island community, and despite the fact that it's been a naval base for so many hundreds of years and so on, actually, in mental terms, in terms of its worldview, you might say, has tended to live with its back to the sea until fairly recently. Not just in real terms, as you very well know, because of threats from the sea, corsairs, pirates, whatever you want to call them. Our communities only recently, in historical terms, established themselves back on the sea, unless it was in a fortified circumstance like Valletta or the Three Cities was. Otherwise, all these major places where people live nowadays, Slema, for example, where I come from, or all these huge, well, by our standards, conurbations such as St. Paul's Bay, Aura, and so on, and the south of the island as well. There's a lot of people who live by the sea nowadays who in the past would never even have, well, never have crossed their mind to actually do that. Or St. Julian's, they were typically just a few huts, fishermen's huts, and they would ordinarily live in a larger village in the hinterland. You know, people from Birkirkara would be in St. Julian's, for example.
We used to have a bit of a siege mentality. Yes, you couldn't really blame us.
No, understandably. It was an understandable survival sort of a tactic used by people, because being close to the sea was bad news. I mean, the same, incidentally, I mean, we can immediately go abroad, and you talked about Spain. Spain is exactly the same. In Spain, only fortified ancient cities were by the sea. The major conurbations, the major centers of habitation in the up to the early modern period, and even well into the contemporary period, in other words, even into the 19th century, were away from the coast. So much so that, to some extent, there was quite a revolution when the tourism boom came to Spain, because typically the eldest sons would have the good land away from the sea. That was the valuable land in a rural agriculture-based society. But when tourism came along and land became at a premium, same as in Malta, those who were left with the little bits and pieces close to the sea, because they were not good for agriculture, actually, they turned the tables on their elders.
They were the winners.
And they were the sort of winners in the end. So, going back to this question of how we conceive it, even in our literature, believe it or not, this is also the case in Britain, actually, despite the fact that, you know, we know, and you know, and I know, and many people know, because of our association with the Royal Navy and the Merchant Navy, how much of a seafaring nation Britain is. But nevertheless, having said that, the fact is that if you look at its literature and so on, it doesn't really figure very prominently. It's really quite amazing.
The sea was a dangerous place.
The sea has always been a dangerous place.
Unless you were in a warship.
in a warship. Going to sea has always been an eminently dangerous pursuit. There was a fascinating paper by our Dr. Martin Zamit. I had invited him to participate, in fact, in a congress which was taking place in Tunisia. And he came along, amazed them all, incidentally, with his knowledge of Arabic. I was sitting in the audience, I could hear people speculating, or I was told subsequently they were speculating, but I did hear some people speaking in French and talking about it. Whether he was Syrian or whether he was, it's really quite amazing. I hold him in very high esteem. And he gave this really tremendous paper about in fact the perception of the sea in our language. And as you say, the sea has always been perceived as bad news. Those who have any sense at all stay at home. they stay at home and they are rural. They are I mean, you look at all the kind of fiction stuff which comes out, and the center of gravity of our existence is the parish squares, the square in front of the parish church and the club around it and so on. It's never been the sea, really. Really, that's why I say, I mean, by we've always lived with our back to the sea, and it's not just us, a lot of people.
I remember Professor Wettinger in one of his lectures shocking a room full of 18-year-olds by having the temerity to suggest that before a certain time, I think in the 19th century, probably with the opening of the Suez Canal, prior to that, you know, Malta, he told them Malta was a backwater, and there was a sort of hushed silence, you know, in the room, and everyone went.
No, we've always suffered from this, but this is inevitable. I mean, everybody. I mean, after all, even in these kind of globalized times that we live in, most people's lives are carried on sort of like 90% of the time, 95% of the time. They married, if not the girl next door, the girl sort of just down the road from them. They circulate, they shop, they. Are born and die within a very small area. This has not really essentially changed. Oh, of course, it's changed somewhat. There's apparently, because very often these things are apparent. I mean, people have always moved about massive numbers. Look at the 19th century and the massive movement of Europeans to the Americas. We're talking of mega numbers. So nowadays, the movement is in other directions. But people have always moved. That's point number one. But nevertheless, anyway, the important thing is that we always sort of feel that where we are from, Malta Fior del Mondo, no? That this is the center of the universe. There are some important misconceptions. And there are some areas, I hope I've remedied some of the lacuna that we have. For example, my most recent work was, in fact, on labor to do with the sea. Even though we know that many people, many people's family, there is the memory, if not actually still a surviving member, of people who have served in the Royal Navy. Also, people who have served in the Merchant Navy or the hybrid navy, which is the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, which is a civilian man, but at the same time it is under the what you might call military discipline. And yet, I was really quite amazed. I was prompted by this because my grandfather died in the Navy. Drowned or he died in Narvik in the Second World War. My great-grandfather also died in the war, but in the First World War in the Navy. And there are many families who, if not actually still alive, they can trace family members who, particularly during the British period, had family in, because there was a family tradition very often, you know, it would be son would inherit from the father or father to son, uncles. There was a tradition of serving in the British Navy, in the Royal Navy, but also in the Merchant Navy. And that's the most recent work I've done, which, in fact, looks at the numbers to establish that it was an extremely attractive thing. And obviously, if you were in the Royal Navy and it was peacetime, which is most of the time, luckily, it was really a cushy job. You were set up for life. I mean, people often talk about what an elite, a working class elite, the people in the dockyard were in comparison to being a steward eventually, or being on board a Royal Navy ship or a cook. It was really nothing, because they were really well paid. And more importantly, and this time, at that time of history, they had something which now is taken for granted, but at that time was very, very rare. They had pensions. It was amazing. There were pensions available for people. But obviously, periodically you got the king's shilling, but periodically you were actually called to account. You had to go to war for it. And then, believe it or not, because I've used as a source, a very interesting source. I was quite surprised it had not been used before, actually. There is a data bank of all those who died in the war. And divided according to the to the service that they were in. Even civilians, for example, in the case of Malta, all the civilians who died, there is the details of them in this Commonwealth sort of Graves Commission data bank. And I used the information available there, and also Admiralty stuff, obviously, from British archives. And there's a lot of information. Proportionately more Maltese died in the war than British naval personnel died in the war, which may come to it as a surprise to some, partly for a number of reasons. It's a complex issue, but part of the reason that probably we have a high, we had a higher casualty rate in both the First and the Second World War is the fact that in the First World War, there's a sea change, if you pardon the pun, from the First to the Second World War. In the First World War, typically the average Maltese engaged by the Navy was, in fact, a fireman, as they know. There were jobs to do with, and stokers, there were jobs to do with loading coal into the furnaces, moving the coal around to make it, to prepare it for loading into the furnaces. They were all very, very, first of all, very dirty jobs. It was very hot work. Incidentally, I mean, suicide rates, not amongst Maltese probably because of the religious kind of convictions, but suicide rates amongst stokers, they would just be so hot, they would, the temperatures reached in stokes and so on, in boiler rooms, would be so high, they would just go crazy and jump overboard in an attempt to cool, and obviously in the process die. So it was very dangerous work, but in the event of, in the event of hostilities and engagement with the enemy, what would in fact happen would be that if you're down in the hold, your chances of making it to the top of the ship goes down are pretty kind of minimal, you know. I mean, if you're up top, it's okay. It's not too bad. You can probably jump even, oh, mind you, because it depends where you jump, because as I'm sure that my grandfather did in Narvik, if you jump into freezing waters, then you don't really stand much of a chance anyway, or as happened, for example, to the father, he's still alive, of a very good friend of mine, who's with us here at university, Martes Paris. His story is quite remarkable. He jumped into sort of shark-infested waters, and most of them did not make it through. So, you know, but anyway, but setting aside these cases of freezing or being eaten up by sharks, if you were down deep in the hold,
you
didn't really stand much of a chance. Yeah. So that probably is the reason why the casualty rate for Maltese was so high. But I'm focusing too much on this.
It's very, very interesting stuff, because it's sort of
it's very novel, first of all, because there's a lot of it was motivated. It was really it started off as,
about people,
as my way to pay homage to my grandfather, actually. But because when I looked around to find out what there was hardly anything available on this, and there was hardly anything about, for example, just to talk about anecdotes, because I used interviews and stuff as well. The way it was normally done was, in fact, there was not a formal recruitment system in the beginning. There would be somebody who would be a steward or a cook or something like that in the Second World War, and he would take a young man under his wings with the captain's permission, and he would feed him, he would kind of set a little sort of corner for him in his own space, and only when he felt he had been adequately kind of pre-trained would he put him up for a formal enlistment by the service. But anyway, that is a very particular localized situation of maritime history. But maritime history, as we started off with at the beginning, really incorporates so much if we conceive it the way we look at it. Obviously, there's clearly the resources of the sea, you know, fishing and the communities that have to do with fishing. And nowadays also those who live from fish farming and oil extraction or gas extraction. The sea as a means of communication, obviously, which is the widest concept, carriage of people, goods, ideas, all the structures associated with that, sea-related labor, many, many aspects. Most trade, even nowadays, despite the advent of planes, most trade overwhelmingly is still carried by sea.
I'm always amazed to see how many containers ships there are out at sea waiting to go into the Freeport.
It is really amazing.
Sometimes at night you see the lights.
And the Mediterranean is still one of the busiest thoroughfares, of one of the busiest sea lanes. It's really amazing that we don't have more accidents. But going back to this question of this wide concept, obviously then there is the one about the projection of power, then the traditional one of naval history, then obviously the use of the sea for scientific purposes and so on, oceanography and there's also the question of the sea as a space for leisure. I mean, nowadays it is an extremely important, and I'm not talking just about cruise ships or something. Keep in mind that for a long time, sea bathing was not considered a done thing.
Even
countries like, for example, Australia and California, which we now conceive as the ultimate kind of beach culture places. I was amazed to find out that the only way that people could go and swim in Australia at the beginning of the 19th century, of the 20th century, my apologies, at the beginning of the 20th century, would be at night when people could not see you. There was such a thing about, you know, this sort of Christian need to hide one's body and so on, that it was not done to actually go and swim. So, and as you said, I mean, most people were afraid of getting close to the sea anyway. So, which, by the way, is in sharp contrast to the Roman epoch. When in the Roman period, when you had, first of all, you had...
They certainly like their swimming pools.
Exactly. I mean, they had these villas by the sea and so on, which was amazing. So it was partly, obviously, the loss of the Mare Nostrum sort of thing, you know, this peace imposed by the Romans on what had been pirate infested sort of waters, but also the advent of Christianity had apparently a very, very, very big impact on this, on the idea of nakedness is not, in sharp contrast to Greek and Roman traditions, it was not a thing to do, you know.
And then we had the Puritans in the north of Europe as well,
Puritans, where there was the northern version and there was the southern variant. Yeah. And, I mean, it's like in the high Middle Ages, as you know, you had some really remarkable contrast between the Muslims and the public bathing places, hammams and so on, and the Christians who are, believe they always talk about Queen Victoria sort of bathing once or twice a year or something. We changed. But obviously there's also finally the question of the sea and culture and ideology, its presence in literature, as I said.
And painting.
Painting, we're lucky in that way, because Malta is really quite a remarkable, as you undoubtedly know, it's quite a remarkable repository of a lot of sea-related painting, and also, of course, we have the famous work done by Muscat and others on the Ex Votos, which are such a remarkable representation and testimony, if nothing else, of what the ships look like, you know, very often. It's really quite a range. So the basic general point, bottom line, is that Mediterranean Maritime History Network conceives of history as a very wide spectrum of pursuits, from water polo. In fact, I prepared, I was commissioned to write an article, and one of the fascinating things, for example, is water polo here in Malta, which has always had such a following, introduced by the Brits, by the way, as have so many other sports. And yet, you know, people really took to it because it's by the sea, it's all sorts of things. Anyway.
In the last couple of minutes that we have, though, perhaps you could...
Is it only last couple of minutes? Has time gone by so swiftly?
Absolutely. I'm sorry about that. You are actually going to have a meeting in Izmir next MMHN. You're going to have an enormous amount, I was looking at the list, enormous amount of papers, and really which follow what you've just been saying, that the breadth of interest in maritime studies. Perhaps you could just pick on one or two just...
Well, as you said, I mean, most of the papers sort of have been grouped at least, but we also have special sessions, for example. There's a considerable interest in Venice. We have actually have two sessions on Venice and the Mediterranean, which have been put together by Professor Ruthie Gertwagen from the University of Haifa and Jean-Claude Hoquet, and about the Greek diaspora as well. But a novelty this year, and I'm particularly satisfied, I'm particularly happy with this, because it's going to take place, in fact, in Izmir, away from Malta. We actually have a special session on the port of Malta, which will be chaired by Professor Henry Frindo, but there will be, for example, interesting tidbits. Gentleman, Professor Akif from the University of the Aegean in Turkey, is going to present the Great Siege of Malta of 1565, new information about the Ottoman perspective. Yes, I spoke with them, and he has apparently, they've just kind of opened up a whole new section of what used to be the kind of the high state organism which decided on these things. And he's promising me some really nice tidbits. But there's local people as well, but there's going to be Alain Blondy as well. And so I'm particularly happy that we're actually going to have a special session just for the port of Malta.
It's always interesting as well to see how other people look
perceive us,
at us. We're used to sort of seeing our own historians, yourself obviously, and other people like Henry talking about Malta.
Yes, but I think it's very important that people look beyond Malta. And this week, Charles Dalli from the History Department got in touch with me because they presently have some EU project to collect bibliography which has to do with kind of like whatever, you know, in other words, bibliography or material or research or publications which have to do with relations between countries and across borders and so on. And I looked, and when he told me to submit to him what I'd done, which fell within the parameters which he had to look at, I found out that, in fact, everything that I've done has to do with, because Malta's an island. Practically by definition, we have to relate to other countries and so on. So, but anyway.
Well, that was extremely interesting. I'm so glad that you found the time to come and talk to us today, Professor Karim Basallo. And perhaps we can have another session after the event so you can tell us all those secrets about...
One thing I can tell you is that one of the reasons that that Mediterranean Maritime History Network has been included in Intuta, this kind of on the best resources available on the internet, is that we try to open up the information. So, for example, prior to the conference, we put abridged footnote-less versions of the papers online already. First of all, because it enables participants to be able to read up on them and have a more meaningful debate once we're actually there. You know, you don't have to, you're not faced with something completely kind of, you know, you can study it, look at it, and go into depth. But also because it enables those who do not actually physically attend the conference to have access to the information, to research being conducted by people from all over the world on the Mediterranean.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.